Welcome to Music Journeys. I'm Mike Foley. Low Cut Connie brings a high-energy show to the Rumba Cafe Tuesday, November 19th. The band represents the heart and soul of Adam Wiener, and coming up, you'll hear all about Adam's journey in music, the Low Cut Connie documentary film, and the companion audio release. He also delivers some soulful selections in the listener favorite segment called The Fast Five. Adam from Low Cut Connie, our featured guest on this edition of Music Journeys. Thanks for listening.
Yo, my pals, this is Adam, aka Low Cut Connie, and this is my music journey.
Version of All These Kids Are Way Too High opens the 13-track Connie Live, the audio companion to the Low Cut Connie feature film Art Dealers. For band leader Adam Wiener, the love of music and art began at an early age.
The radio that would play in our house, my parents loved Motown, and my parents liked to dance, and I would see them dance to Motown, and that music got in my bloodstream. I saw the movie Amadeus about Mozart when I was very young, 4, and I saw him play piano upside down behind his back. My parents caught me trying to do that, plinking out little twinkle, twinkle, little star behind my head on the piano. I've been obsessed with music and the language of music since I was a very small kid. Born and raised in South Jersey, New Jersey. It's funny, a lot of my musical heroes are also from the burbs. I've thought about this a lot recently. People like Patti Smith, who grew up, 5 minutes from where I grew up. In fact, I worked in high school and college. I worked at the mall in the town where she went to high school. Patti Smith, Bruce Springsteen, Lou Reed, Billy Joel, all these people that like grew up in the burbs, I can really relate to their music because I hear this sort of like hunger, this drive to change their circumstances, reinvent themselves, and kind of like take over the joint, you know? And there's something about growing up in the suburbs. David Bowie was a suburban kid in England too, and I hear that in his music. So I feel like that music, that attitude of growing up in suburban New Jersey crept into my music pretty young. I stayed in the one town until I was 18 and I moved to New York City and my life began really. You know, I got a job playing piano in a restaurant the first week that I was in New York City. The first month I was in New York, I was 18. We got hired to dance at the reopening of the Limelight Club in New York. And it was just a crazy scene. And so it was like 18, I feel like my life began because all of a sudden I was dumped into this crazy art scene. Chicago Station in the middle of the night, I'm speaking to the Japanese fans. I pull some strings and step into the light with tiny shutters, shaking my head. Hey! Don't entertain me. Don't entertain me, can entertain myself. Yeah. Don't entertain me. Don't entertain me, can entertain myself. I bombed my way through my 20s. I played every kind of gig you can imagine. My band and I in my 20s used to play all these dive bars to 3 drunk people. I played piano for ballet classes in Greenwich, Connecticut for a couple years. I played piano in gay bars all over New York City. That was sort of my bread and butter gig, which I loved. And then I started touring around the country and I used to play guitar and stamp my foot on a box. That was my act. That was called Lady Fingers. And I did it for like 10 years, man. And I failed. I mean, I truly and utterly failed. I did not make fans. I did not make money. I did not get signed. I didn't get an agent. But I just kept doing it and doing it over and over. I look back on it now and I'm like, why was I doing that? Why did I get addicted to performing for hostile audiences? And I get it now. I was learning. It's like a stand-up comedian. You have to get up for 5 minutes at these open mic nights as a stand-up comic. You bomb, you bomb, you bomb, and then you learn how to hit. Throughout my 20s, I bombed and bombed and bombed. And by the time I was 30, I knew how to kill. I knew how to kill a crowd because I had worked at it in front of the most hostile, unforgiving audiences you can imagine.
So what turned it? What is that secret to working the crowd?
Skill set, man. What's what I call stage IQ? I can watch my heroes of the stage, Tina Turner, James Brown, Prince, Mick Jagger, Freddie Mercury, Bruce Springsteen, Iggy Pop, some of the greatest live performers ever. And what I see is high stage IQ. They know how to make you feel like they want you to feel, right? If they want to take you to church, they're going to take you to church. If they want you to cry, you're going to cry. They want you to laugh, you're going to laugh. They want you to feel uplifted and joyful. That's what they're going to achieve. And it really bothered me that I didn't know how to take people where I wanted them to go, the audience. And so I worked on my stagecraft. I used to get heckled a lot in the early days. And in fact, I did a show at the Southgate House right outside of Cincinnati, not far from you guys. I was in my young 20s and I got up on this stage and somebody screamed at me after my first song. And I froze. And it was like all the air was going out of the balloon in the room. It was so awkward. Over the years, I just learned how to deal with something like that and turn it like a stand-up comic. They get heckled and they have to learn how to turn it back in their favor and get the audience back on their side. So I start to learn how to say things like, wow, what an attractive audience we have here tonight in Cincinnati. What a wonderful group of kind Midwesterners we have. You learn all these little things. One of the first things I learned, look at your audience. Make eye contact with your audience. Do it in the first 20 seconds of the show. Most bands, they get on stage and they're kind of looking at their feet, they're looking at their guitar tuner, and they say, "Hey, how you doing, Columbus?" And then they start playing a song and then they start tuning their guitar. Man, I'm out. My attention span is too short for that. Even if I like your music, like your records, I'm going to get bored real fast. But you look at me, you make eye contact with me, you let me know you see me. Okay, I'm going to pay attention to you and see what you have to say.
This is called Sleaze Me On, New York.
You've got the concert film and documentary. You've got a companion live album. What do you think this captures?
Magic is the word I'll use. See, there's like a thing that happens that you can't describe in words. You've been to a lot of concerts, you've been to a lot of live performances. Once in a while, there's like a magic night. Maybe you go see a show that's good, and for the next week, you tell people, "Hey, I went to see that artist, they were really cool." But will you talk about it in 10 years? Will you talk about it in 20 years? It's those magic nights that really shake people's bones. They get into their bloodstream. I've experienced some of those as an audience member. And I've been on the other side. I've been able to provide some magic nights for some people. And I became really obsessed with capturing that magic night in a film. I want people to watch the film and be like, shook. Wow, you got me. I'm in. I feel good. I feel different. I feel elevated. And so, you know, the stars just kind of aligned coming out of the pandemic. Everybody was so pent up. And we had this opportunity to make this film in one night. And it was the one of the first shows where people could take their masks off and touch each other. It was one of the first shows where I could run out in the crowd and hug people. And there was this cathartic rush. This film crew and this audio team did an amazing job of capturing. And when I saw the footage and I heard the audio, I said, we have a movie.
Let me see some hands. I love you, babies. I used to be a soldier. Now I'm getting older. Start to feel so lazy. It starts to make me crazy.
Both enjoying and suffering from consciousness every day that we're alive. Sometimes it's something we enjoy. Sometimes it's something we suffer from. Lately, I feel like my job is to get people out of the digital sphere because we're also tapped in to our phones and the social media community through our devices that sometimes people are distracted away from real life flesh experience that's happening around them. And so I do feel like a big part of my job initially during a show is to shake people up and make them feel very conscious of their surroundings, their body, the people around them, the room, the smells, the lights, the heat. I want them to feel very present. And then once I have them present, I want them to feel elevated. I want them to feel better at the end of the show than they did at the beginning. And I guess you would describe that as catharsis, really. And by the way, it's not escapism. I'm not trying to make everybody forget about all the horrible, depressing, troubling things happening in the world and in their lives. It's actually a way of processing it, right? In the show, we talk about a lot of dark things. A lot of my songs are dark, but we work through them. Kind of like the way people do in church or synagogue or wherever they go for spiritual uplift. I happen to be an atheist Jew. I don't have a spiritual practice. I don't pray. I don't go to a house of worship. I go to rock and roll. I go into theaters and clubs, and that's where I get my spiritual fix.
Come on. Say hey. Men, boys, and girls are stuck in Toledo. Cause they found the dime bags in my shoes. I had to sell my old tuxedo just to talk to you. We'll be right back.
We did a benefit concert for the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh a month after the mass shooting in 2018. I'll never forget that show, and it's a whole sequence in the film. I encourage people to go watch that. It was very nerve-wracking to know how to approach that show because people were in pain, people were really grieving, and we couldn't just come out and just be outrageous and sexy and funny. You know, I have to speak to the moment. And so I decided to go out there and actually address the community and the people from the synagogue who were there. And you can see the performance in the film. It's one of the most powerful evenings I've ever been a part of. On the flip side, you can see a sequence in the film that's some really old footage of me performing in all these little divey bars. I did this tour in 2007, 2008 that a friend of mine filmed because he told me, "What you're doing is so pathetic. I want to capture it. I've never seen anything so pathetic." And you can see a man bomb on stage. I mean, I'm performing and there's like a college football game going on TV, and these guys are just smoking their cigarettes, yelling at me to shut up so they can watch the game, you know? So, you know, in the life of a performer, that's the range that we live, you know, from one gig to the other.
But as you said, you needed that to learn. You know, it made me think of this, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the NPR Tiny Desk stuff. Well, that started when the guys behind that were in a bar and there was games on, but there was a musician there, and I think her name was Laura Gibson, and they couldn't hear her, so they just said, "Hey, would you come by our office and play?" She did. They filmed it, and that became all these tiny desk things that you see. So it was crazy.
Wow, but, I didn't know that's how it started. We have yet to do one, but I hope that we will. Yeah, that would be fun.
I don't know if the desk could hold you, Adam, and the gang. I mean, that would be the ultimate. That would be great. We got to make that happen.
I'm scalable. Man, I could perform in a phone booth. I can perform in the, you know, as you see in the film, there's a shot of us in an alleyway outside of a venue. We were doing a concert and the fire alarm went off and the whole crowd was in the street. And so you can see the scene in the film where the crowd and I are singing together and everybody's having a great time. If we could do that, we could do Tiny Desk, let me tell you.
Absolutely. Beverly or Shake It Little Tina, what gets you going the most?
As you can tell, I've written a lot of songs with girls' names in it. And I think, man, I've just met so many different people over these years of traveling, and some of them end up in the song. We just put out the live version of Charisse. I've got a song called Oh Suzanne. But, you know, Tina, Shake It Little Tina, is not actually about specifically Tina Turner or any woman that I knew. It's actually about a drag queen that I used to work with.
Yeah.
maitre d' of this drag karaoke bar where I used to play piano was like a 4'11" guy from China who used to dress up like Tina Turner on Saturdays, and I would play piano for him, and he shook it like Tina Turner every Saturday, and that's where that song came from.
Of the Low Cut Connie catalog, what stands out for you maybe in how they started and how they, or maybe how they started and how they feel when you play it in front of, you know, whether it's 10 people or 10,000 people?
There's a song called Big Thighs, New Jersey that is on our first Low Cut Connie album. It's a song I wrote in my late 20s. Things weren't going great for me. And I wrote this song and I started playing it for people. In fact, on the Blu-ray of Art Dealers, there's a camcorder clip of the first time I played that song. I think it was 2007, and in the bonus features. And there were some people buzzing around me who were in the music business for a minute, and they told me, "That's one of your weird songs. You should throw that one away." And you know, Low Cut Connie became the place where I did all my weird songs, all the rejects. And so we put this song, Big Thighs, New Jersey, on our first album. And I'll tell you, it didn't really get a lot of attention. And we never would play the song. I would say for 10 years, we didn't really play the song. And during the pandemic, I don't know what happened, but it starts streaming in the millions. And all these younger fans who were discovering us streaming were listening to Big Thighs, New Jersey and making videos of themselves to the song.
What kind of film were we using back then? I tried to take one for the team. Who wrote the words to the songs we sang? The death reggae of our dreams. Well, you're the black sheep of the fair. And when a black sheep learns to kill, you can leave Big Thighs, New Jersey, with a great big space to fill. Boys and girls, I never thought I'd be sitting here 11 years later playing this song. So I want to thank each and every one of you for making my dream come true.
And it's become kind of like an anthem for anybody who's a misfit or an other, whether it be because of the color of their skin, their gender identity, their sexual orientation, their just their general strangeness in the place where they grow up and how they will blossom later, you know? It's one of those It Gets Better Later songs. And I'm so touched that that song has become one of our biggest anthems 13 years after I put it out.
It's amazing. It's the magic again and the power of music again, I guess, right?
You never know what happens with a song. A song is like a living organism. And some of them die off quick and they're never heard from again. And some of them, you know, have a whole second, third, fourth life, you know? You never know.
You know, listeners, I'm sure you've run into them, can explain how much music means to them, whether it's yours or someone else's, you know, what they get from it. But as the artist, can you describe what music means to you, what it means to you to have done this and have, you know, started a certain way and come to this point and now you've got this documentary?
It's elemental. I don't know anything else. I never really had a plan B. I did teach and had a teaching job. Into my middle 30s, by the way, but giving up playing music was never an option for me. You know, there's a phrase, a life in the theater is a good life. You know, a life on stage playing music is a great life, whether you do it in a wedding band, in a karaoke group, at open mic night, or playing arenas. It's just a great way to go through life and be an art dealer, as I say. And so I'm just very lucky that I get to do this for a living and play music every day for amazing people.
We are the lucky ones. A little more fun with Adam Wiener in the Fast Five. Here we go.
I'm nervous.
Great. All right. First song you can remember hearing that you loved.
When Doves Cry. Dig if you will the picture. If you and I engage in a kiss.
And what was it about that that struck you so much?
And still to this day, 40 years later, there's no song like When Doves Cry. I mean, it's a universe and a genre in and of itself. There's nothing before it that sounds like it. There's nothing after it that sounds like it. When Doves Cry is a truly, truly great song.
Oh, you're so right. How about a song that makes you feel the most nostalgic, sparks memories for you?
Madonna, Borderline. Borderline. Feels like I'm going to lose my mind. You just keep on pushing my love on the borderline. I'm a child of the 80s. You know, Madonna is like the absolute top 80s artist for me. It just reminds me of my childhood, the better aspects of my childhood, and this very weird, eclectic, positive energy that she gave off in the 80s that made a lot of us want to get up and dance and do this for a living.
I'm a child of the 80s too. And speaking of dancing, how about your go-to song for dancing? A tune that you hear, you just can't sit still when you hear it.
Let's do James Brown's Sex Machine. Get up, get on up, get up, get on up. JB, man, how many people in the history of recorded music can actually say that they truly changed the course of not only music history, but they have really changed the course of history? I mean, James Brown really affected the culture to this day. He was a genius of rhythm. He was a genius of the stage, but his music was absolutely revolutionary rhythmically. If you can't dance to Sex Machine, you might be dead. Yeah.
How about the song that makes you feel like working out or maybe motivates you to do something, get something done that you don't feel like doing at the time? Kind of that motivator tune.
Yeah, man. I would say The Stooges, Down in the Street. Down in the street where the faces shine. Iggy Pop, man. One of the greats. I saw Iggy with the Stooges reunite when I was about 22, 23 years old. And it's still to this day, talk about gigs you talk about forever. It's still the high watermark for a rock and roll performance that I've ever seen. I've never seen somebody perform like Iggy did on that show. Man, he just gets me going. And the Stooges are just one of the greatest bands ever. And if I really need to get slapped across the face, I put on the Stooges.
All right, last one. A song that lifts you up when you're feeling down.
I would say Otis Redding. It's really hard to pick one, but That's How Strong My Love Is. That's how strong my love is. That's how strong my love is. Man, Otis, man, in times of crisis, in times of sadness, in times where I feel really challenged, Otis is a go-to for me. Otis Redding with Booker T and the MGs. That's the essence of soul music right there.
It certainly is, and you're a go-to for us. Adam, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for enriching our lives with your music, and we can't wait for your return to Columbus.
Oh, man, November 19th at the Rumba Cafe, baby. And you know I'm going to be getting some Dirty Frank's hot dogs that night. I'll see all my Columbus pals there. Thank you so much, my pal.
Special thanks to our intern, Simon Pokrand, for production help on the Fast Five. And thank you for listening to 90.5 FM, WCBE Columbus, 106.3 in Newark, online at wcbe.org. I'm Mike Foley. Talk to you again on the next Music Journey.
I'm Raghav Raj. I'm the student intern here at 90.5 WCBE. Did you know that you can tune into this show on WCBE's new app? Whether you're on the go or staying home, the WCBE app lets you listen to our programming online anytime. For local music, community news, and original podcasts, find WCBE on the App Store or the Google Play Store today.
David Brown formed Harmony Project in Columbus in 2009 to build a stronger, more inclusive community through music and service. An initial chorus of 100 people has grown to more than 1,000, with Brown taking his concept into schools and prisons to share what music gave him.
Music was where I was not excluded. Music was where I could close my door and I could imagine an audience in front of me and singing and dancing and having a great time. That just became the natural salvation. Like if you lead with, come sing, even if you've been told you can't. Come sing if you want your voice to be part of something greater. Come sing if you know that you would never be able to be on a stage or never be able to back up some big artist. Come sing with me. Harmony allows every single person who participates to be a part of something greater than themselves.
Music Journeys features the inspirational David Brown and Harmony Project. Listen to Music Journeys on the major podcast platforms, the WCBE app, and at WCBE.org.
I'm Michael Kent, host of the Internet Says It's True podcast, where we talk about things that sound made up but are actually true. Like the fact that as many as 10,000 people were killed when the government poisoned alcohol during Prohibition. Or how Abraham Lincoln jailed journalists and city council members that he thought might sympathize with Confederates. Or how the CIA once had a top-secret heart attack weapon. All of these stories and more are available to you. Just search for The Internet Says It's True on the NPR One app or at the WCBE Podcast Experience.